The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. This is Steve Lenman. I've got Jack Rasmus back. Jack, professor of political economy out at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University in California. Oh, he's got some marvelous. Jack's writings are just marvelous, and I follow them all the time when I spot them. And I like to mention Jack's book, his most recent one, called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. And his new one, forthcoming this year, is called Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few. And the last time Jack was on, I said maybe change the subtitle to Recovery for the Very Few. I think based on the policies that are ongoing and seem to be getting worse, that they're getting fewer and fewer and fewer. Well, Jack and I both wrote about the same topic, dissecting Obama's State of the Union address. We came at it from different angles. Jack, from an economic point of view, job creation, he stressed in his article. I'm sure Jack wants to talk about that. I covered a lot of ground. I cover a lot of geopolitical issues and so on. Jack, I'll just mention how I started my article off. I said Obama is taking credit for what should be condemned, and then I used a lot of polite expletives describing him, very truthful ones, I must say. And then I said his State of the Union address was beginning to end doublespeak, duplicity, cover-up, denial of failed public policies, complicit with Wall Street crooks, war profiteers, and other corporate favorites, while popular needs go begging. Certainly one of the biggest popular needs, Jack, is a job with a living wage and decent benefits, and they're getting scarcer and scarcer. Welcome, Jack.
My pleasure.
Talk about your article. You went through it.
Maybe we should start talking about the GDP numbers that just came out yesterday. That would be a good topic.
Oh, that'd be a good one. Well, they're not going up, are they?
It all depends how you look at it. And what you don't look at is the question. You know, first of all, let me preface it by saying two things. One, people want a deeper analysis, my analysis on that. I would point them to my blog, where I'm putting an article up today, which we'll talk about what I'm saying here and a little bit more. My blog is just Jack Rasmus, JackRasmus.com, and there'll be an article there on comment on the recent GDP numbers. Getting to the GDP numbers per se, if you look at they said 2.8% growth. And, that looks like it's rising compared to what it was earlier in the year. You know, first quarter of last year, it was only 0.4%. And then it went up to about 1.3%. So the first half of the year was like 0.8%, 0.8 of 1%. Okay, not even 1% growth rate, which is really interesting. At that point from a recovery from recession, you usually had growth rates of 5 to 10%, and here we're less than 1%. Now, the other third quarter, we get 1.3%, and every quarter it's revised down. You see, GDP is offered three times in a year. They give you an advance number, and then they adjust it twice in a year. What we got, this 2.8%, is the first advance number. But the point is that 2.8% compares to a total average last year for the first 9 months of barely 1%, a little over 1%, about 1.2. So it looks like it's growing. Oh, 2.8 versus 0.1. I guess that means that you know, we got a recovery going, and that's what you hear in the papers, you know, newspapers and so forth, and the media pundits. Oh, it's taking off finally. But look what happened to the stock market. You would think if we had the greatest growth last quarter in the last several years that the stock market would have boomed, right? Oh, growth coming. Everybody's buying. We're on a recovery. The stock market fell. That ought to tell you something. That tells you that people who are able to look behind the 2.8% aren't so impressed with it, because the truth is in the details. And if you look at 2.8%, what do you have here? Let me explain. It's really about 1%. In other words, the average that we've had over the past year. We're still stumbling along the bottom, which confirms my analysis in my book, Epic Recession, that once you have one of these crises, they bail out the banks, they bail out big corporations, and they don't bail out Main Street, and you bump along the bottom for years. And I mean, it could be 7-10 years where you have little glimmers of growth that collapse, and soft patches, and pretty much stagnant. And that's really where we are today. You know, the economy is about where it was in 2007. So we're coming on 5 years now where our total GDP growth is no more than it was 5 years ago. Well, 4.5 at least, okay? So let's look at the numbers GDP last quarter specifically. What's wrong with them? Why is it closer to 1% than 2.8%? Here's the reason. Two reasons, main reasons. Inventories. Inventories, that's what business does when they purchase more goods, more raw material, and they store them, and they wait for the consumer really to roar back. You know, and that way they make more profits because they pay for the stuff that they bought and stored less than they would when people start buying. In the third quarter, July to September, inventories were absolutely flat. They collapsed. Okay, we come to the fourth quarter, and we get a huge inventory boost. In other words, what was bottled up in the third quarter passes through into the fourth quarter. When you talk about 2.8%, 1.9 of that 2.8 was all inventory building. And that's significant. That means the rest of the economy, business spending, consumer spending, government spending, is still flat on its back, only about 1%. Now, you could argue that some of that 1.9% would have been normal. So let's be generous and say, okay, only half of the 1.9% we should count, because you know, half of it was in the third quarter that got bottled up, and now it just got released into the fourth quarter. So let's take and assume inventory contribution to the 2.8% was really 1% in the fourth quarter. That leaves us with about 1.8% growth rate in the fourth quarter. In other words, some of that growth of 2.8% was really in the third quarter, and it got passed through, blocked up, and then got passed through into the fourth quarter. So it's really only about 1.8%, but that's not the whole story still. What else represents the 1.8% being an overestimation? It's the adjustment for inflation. There's a price index. You know, all these numbers we're talking about, 2.8%, is supposed to be real GDP, not just reflected in price increases, because that doesn't mean there's any growth. It just means business is raising prices and taking more profits from people. GDP is the total of all goods and services produced and sold in a particular time period in the U.S. So that means prices. You know, when you sell something, you got a price. The GDP deflator is what the index, price adjustment index, is called for GDP. Now, in the fourth quarter, they estimated that the inflation adjustment was only 0.4%, 0.4%. In other words, inflation was less than 0.5% is what they're saying. Now, that's ridiculous. We all know inflation was a heck of a lot more than 0.5%. You know, food is rising, gas is rising, rents are really rising for people who are renting, right? College tuition is rising. Health insurance companies are gouging us again at 20%. Premium increases all across the board, less than 0.5%. Now, why is that important? Because the lower the inflation adjustment, the higher the recorded real GDP growth rate. In other words, if we said that inflation was really 1%, not less than 0.5%, that would have meant about 0.6% should have been adjusted off of the 1.8 remainder GDP growth. So it would have been 1.2%. So if you take just the inventory, the unique situation with the inventory adjustment, and if you say it was ridiculous to assume less than one-half of 1% growth, I mean inflation, you would have a GDP of about 1 to 1.2% in the fourth quarter. And you know that's what we've had all year long. So I believe investors, Wall Street types, who drive the stock market, looked behind these numbers and saw, oh, this was all inventories, or, oh, this was a ridiculous price adjustment. You know, inflation was much higher. Oh, growth is really about 1%. It's not 2.8%. See, there's all kind of games you play with these numbers when you do statistical operations on these numbers. And it's not just GDP, but it's employment numbers, inflation numbers. What they've done over the last several decades since Reagan is fine-tune these government statistics so that they smooth them out. In other words, so we don't get big swings in prices or wages or jobs. Job numbers are notorious. I've got another problem with the fourth quarter job numbers, particularly December. We can talk about that too. I don't want to get too arcane about this stuff because, you know, it's statistics and it's hard for the average person if they haven't studied how they manipulate these numbers. But if you look at it, things are generally worse than the statistics reveal because the statistics, the manipulations, not the raw data, the manipulations on them are designed to smooth out the swings. You know, if you look at the raw data of jobs last month, okay.
Jack, can I stop you 1 second?
Yes.
I take a look once in a while at economist John Williams' material. I'm not a subscriber, so all I get are the headlines. His fourth quarter GDP growth was 0.8%.
Well, we're not too far off, right?
You're pretty close.
I'm 1.2. He's 0.8. It all depends how much you think probably inflation really was. He's probably saying it was more than 1%.
Oh, indeed, indeed, he does say that.
Yeah, he's probably saying it's like 1.5 or something. That's why he gets a lower 0.8, whereas I'm being very generous to the statisticians in the government and saying, okay, inflation was only 1% in the quarter, but, you know, it definitely was a heck of a lot more than 0.4.
Oh, indeed. He goes back and he re-engineers the numbers based on the way they were calculated in the 1980s, Jack, before they manipulated
the formula. Before the 1980s. You know, the big changes started with Ronald Reagan. And Reagan started adjusting, getting the Labor Department to adjust and the Commerce Department to adjust their numbers to smooth things out and to de-emphasize things. You see, because when inflation is too high, the government has to pay more Social Security increases and more unemployment benefits and other things it has to pay. So the government has an incentive to keep the price inflation numbers lower than they actually are. The government has an incentive to keep the unemployment numbers lower than they are, because if employment hits a certain threshold, they have to provide additional weeks of unemployment benefits, and they have to adjust the unemployment benefits. So there's a big dollar incentive for government to keep the worst indicators lower than they actually are. And, of course, when you're doing this with GDP, you get more of a growth rate. And another weird thing about there's several weird things about GDP here. You know, it's not a perfect indicator of performance of the economy. For example, imports and exports. If American consumers don't have income growth, which they don't, you know, wages rose 1.8% for everybody, including the highly paid, last year, but consumer prices went up 3.6%. last year. So wages and wage growth, and for those at the median or below, it's even worse of a spread, is not growing. It's actually falling. So when consumers and households' income is falling, they're not going to buy as many goods. We know that. And that includes buying imported goods. So when the purchase of imports slows down, even if our exports did not increase, simply because we're not buying as many imports, GDP rises. It's an artificial increase in GDP. It's not a true reflecting that, oh, we produce more goods and services in the United States, therefore we've had a growth. It's simply because we're not buying as many imports. You get a bust, a buildup in GDP. Another one.
Welcome back, and I think we've got Jack back on again. Oh, that was a very, very strange interruption. We just went to break a little bit earlier than we usually do, and I understand that, Jack, your fax machine went off, and first time I've had a fax machine as a guest on this program.
Well, I'm just strange. When the fax machine went off, then everything went off.
Everything went off.
You know, well, that is strange. Something.
I think we both got disconnected.
Off my fax. Where did I lose you? At what point was I talking about?
Oh, my goodness. Where were we? Well, we were still talking about dissecting the true GDP number.
Did I talk about how an increase in imports or changes in imports?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Did I talk about rental income?
Don't think you covered that.
Okay. Well, let me just finish with that. That's another major area where you get a false increase in GDP. In other words, we have 100 million homeowners in this country, and GDP assumes that they're paying themselves rent. I mean, that's really strange. And that the whole value of those payments, rent payments to themselves, of course, they don't write themselves a check and put it in their own bank, but that boosts GDP, particularly when rents are rising, which they are now. You know, 12 million people have foreclosed in the last few years. They got to live somewhere. So they're all competing now for available apartments and apartment prices, as rental folks now are rising significantly. So that's another false indicator of growth in GDP recently, and of course the declining import purchases are another indicator. And then we talked about inventories and so forth, and price adjustments. You know, all these arcane ways of estimating GDP can overestimate it, which is what's happening right now. We're not growing at all. We're still bumping along the bottom at 1% or so, and the stock market knows that, and that's why supposedly the best GDP gain for a quarter in 2.5 years fell on deaf ears in the market, and it went down.
Jack, is it a fair statement to say that post-recession, where the official recession supposedly ended in 2009, post-recession, the so-called recovery is unprecedented in how weak it is? We've never seen such a weak post-recession recovery.
You're absolutely right. The first chapter of my new book, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, and also my pamphlet that was produced just a couple months ago called An Alternative a Program for Economic Recovery, that's available on my website. Both of those show how this current recovery since June 2009 low is by far the weakest compared to all the 11 recessions since 1945, including the worst recessions, which was the Reagan recession and then the 73, the Nixon recession, which were two of the worst of the 11. But this one's twice as bad. In other words, recovery is still lagging, particularly in three areas: jobs, housing, and state and local government. Those three areas. Now, business profits, corporate profits are up there, both, you know, totally. In fact, they're more than recovered where they were in 2007. The bond markets, almost twice as high as where they were in 2007. Bonuses, CEO bonuses up 28-30%. Bankers' bonuses the same. all of these indicators, wealthiest 10% households, especially 1%, they're doing great. You know, you look at what happened with retail sales in December and holidays, right? They said, oh, well, we had a good holiday. Well, the data's coming out now that shows that retail sales were terrible in December. In fact, they only rose 0.1% over December of the previous year. Mm. No, but they didn't rise at all. And that was because of the increase in car sales, which was stimulated by deep discounting going on in the car sector. If it weren't for some purchases of automobiles, we would have been lower this past holiday than we were a year ago. Now, many of the stores that average folks go to, you know, like the Penny's, the Best Buy's, Kohl's, and so forth, they had to deep discount their prices in order to get people to come in. If you look at what happened Black Friday, the third, you know, Friday right after Thanksgiving, big discounts, everybody came in and bought. And then the discounts disappeared for 2 weeks and everyone went home. And then business said, gee, we got to get them back in here, so they discounted again. Those discounts were for most of the households, you know, who go and buy at Penny's and so forth, right? The discounting was so deep that all those companies lost money. You look at what's happening in the reports of the quarter for these companies, they've all taken losses. Penny's taken losses, Kohl's, Best Buy, so forth. Now, that contrasts dramatically with the high-end retail stores. You know, the Saks, the Bloombergs, the Macy's, and so forth. They're doing great. What that means is that wealthy folks, you know, the top 10% households, are buying like, Banshees. And those stores are doing great. But where we shop, you know, median level, where we're all looking for discounts and everything, those stores are doing terrible. That's just an indicator of what's going on. And, of course, you know, why do the top stores do well, and why are the top 10% now constituting over half of all consumption in this country? Well, it's because the stock market went up. And, those folks buy based largely on what their stock is doing. You and I don't have stock, so we don't buy based on that status.
Jack,
but they do.
My understanding is that the last year, the Dow is essentially flat. In other words, it goes up, it comes down, it goes up again. But I think the peak about a year ago is about what the peak is now, give or take a little bit.
Well, not quite. There's been ups and downs in the Dow, and it's better to look at the S&P 500 than the Dow. But there's been ups and downs, and those ups and downs are directly correlated with the Federal Reserve's pumping money into the economy.
Oh, yeah.
Quantitative easing,
yep.
1 and 2, and then in the fall we got Operation Twist, which I call 2.5, 3, quantitative QE3 is coming here later this year. Every time the Fed announces and starts to purchase bonds and so forth in the marketplace, the stock market takes off. And so do, by the way, commodity prices start taking off. Well, the Fed announced last September Operation Twist, it calls QE2, which is really just pumping money into the economy, and the stock market started rising, and it's risen since September. Right? Now, how is that tied in with consumption? Well, if the Fed pumps money into the economy, what it means is speculators come and get that money, either through the banks or shadow banks or whatever. The banks can go and get the free money, or the Fed buys mortgage bonds at their full purchase value rather than the deflated value, which is a big windfall for the mortgage companies and the banks. And then the banks loan that money to hedge funds and private equity funds and so forth, and they institutionals, and they go and buy stocks, and that drives up the stock market. So you see there's a connection there between the Fed pumping money into the economy and eventually ends up in stocks, or they go and buy commodity futures and so forth, or they speculate in real estate somewhere in the world. I talk about that in great detail in my Epic Recession, how the system in the U.S. and globally has shifted towards speculative investing, particularly in financial securities, instead of producing real things that people can get a job for and so forth, you know. People may have not, you know, I'm talking about stocks and bonds, but a lot of it is futures, options, derivatives of all kinds and so forth. And that's where the money is going. And it's stimulating big profits, big inflation, price increases in securities and so forth for the rich. And they don't want to invest, at least in the U.S. or the West anymore. They don't want to invest in making real things. I mean, you know, what's one of the most notable companies that make real things? Apple, right? Apple makes things that people buy. Well, someone's got to build those things. Unfortunately, you know, Apple has 700,000 employees. Unfortunately, they're not in the United States. They're in China, you see. It used to be that in this country, when we invented something that made a thing, we would build it here, and people would get jobs, and incomes would rise, and so forth. But we don't do that anymore. The rich multinational companies just move offshore, and they do it from there. And then they import this stuff back to the United States, and we end up buying their stuff. We're not really buying stuff just from China. We're buying stuff from American companies now in China.
Well, Jack, absolutely. You mentioned Apple. I am an owner of an Apple computer imported from China.
Well, you know, all of your iPhones and so forth, iPads, these are Chinese goods made by Apple under conditions in which Chinese workers are terribly exploited.
Oh, they sure
not just in wages, but working conditions and everything, you know. And they're committing suicide. They're in droves that they're being driven to such an extreme, in unhuman extremes, that they're pushing these workers over there and paying them a pittance. And we end up buying iPads. You know?
It really, it's a modern-day form of, it's wage slavery, a modern-day form of slavery.
These
people are just serfs. And you're right. It's been a long time, but I wrote about how China treats its working people. It is really tremendous. I mean, it's almost like being in prison, Jack. It's so bad.
Yes. It's hard for us to imagine here. You know, the way they deal with us here is we just don't work. You know, and of course we've got still 23, 24 million people out of work in the United States, and that number is only down 1.5 million from its 25 million high. You know, it's like 24 and a half million or something like that. And the number hasn't budged in 3 years. And the reason it hasn't budged is that we've not had a jobs program. What we've had is a let's reduce taxes for wealthy investors and corporations and hope that they create jobs. That's been our program for the first 2 years under Obama. And, of course, we gave them all these tax cuts, and what are they doing? They're just sitting on their money, $2.5 trillion, cash hoard. They're sitting on it. They're dribbling it out, creating jobs. Well, okay, we created supposedly, about a little more than 1.5 million private sector jobs in the last year. Sounds good, doesn't it? Well, you got 24 million to go. And even at 1.5 million, most of those jobs or temporary part-time jobs with no benefits, no job security, nothing. That's what they're adding. GM, last week Obama bragged about GM is back, right? And GM, biggest car company now, and GM is hiring. Well, we lost 315,000 auto jobs during this recession. Last year, GM hired, the auto companies in general, hired 48,000 back. 48,000 only. That's like manufacturing growth of 5,000 a month. You know, if we keep growing manufacturing at 5,000 a month, which is what Obama bragged about, it'll take us 100 years to get the 20 million unemployed back into work. 100 years at that growth rate. But yet, Obama's talking about manufacturing. Manufacturing isn't going to do it, but you know, the manufacturing companies that are in control of his jobs program, specifically GE and its CEO, Jeff Immelt, they love the focus on manufacturing because they benefit. They get more tax cuts, they get more incentives, they get free trade programs that destroy jobs, by the way, and they get less regulations, they get patent control, all this stuff since the summer of 2010, when it's clear Obama's Let's Cut Tax Cuts for Companies program did not create jobs. Obama turned around and said, okay, I'm going to put Jeff Immelt in charge of my jobs program, and we're going to go after manufacturing and exports and free trade to create jobs. Well, it's been 18 months, and what do we get? We get 5,000 jobs a month, which is nothing. But, of course, manufacturing output is still booming, and manufacturing profits are doing great. But there's a dark cloud also on the horizon here, and that's the slowdown in global trade, which is escalating here. And that means manufacturing, U.S. manufacturing, for purpose of exports, is going to decline this year. So even that is not working. We have no jobs program. That's why we have 23, 24 million people still jobless. You know, it's tax cuts for the rich and for corporations, and let's put the fox in charge of the jobs henhouse, you know, Jeff Immelt. And that's what it is. The other big problem is housing. We've never had a recovery from recession without housing recovery, and we have no housing recovery going on. We've got, so far, over 11 million foreclosures in this cycle, and that includes a slowdown last year to only 1.9 million foreclosures. We're running, in 2009 and 10, three million foreclosures a year. Oh, okay, so it's down to 1.9 last year, but that's only because of this robo-scandal. You know, the mortgage companies were just ropely and mechanically throwing people out of their homes, and it created a bit of a stir, and they slowed down their foreclosures, but now they're speeding them up again. 2012, we'll see even more foreclosures. And Obama has no program for foreclosures. Last week, again, he talked about housing. What did he say? He said, well, you know, we're going to do something about homeowners and negative equity. Well, it just came out. You know what he's going to do? What he's been doing for 3 years, and that is giving incentives to mortgage banks to please pass some of it through and lower interest rates for the poor folks facing foreclosure. You know? In other words, we're going to triple the incentives to the banks in the hopes that they'll do what they haven't done for 3 years. Now, is that a program? I don't think so. And then state and local government, you know, nothing's happening there. And they're taking the brunt out in terms of cutting education and cutting health care for people who were disabled and laying off public employees and cutting their pensions and cutting their health care and their wages and so forth. No solution, as I point out in my new book, Obama's Economy. You got to at least address those three sections, jobs, housing, and state and local governments. If you don't, you will not get a sustained recovery. And we won't, and we haven't, and we still won't. And on top of that all, we've got the crisis brewing in Europe, which the Federal Reserve and the big banks and the big boys are all really worried about. That if that happens, if that implosion comes, wow, that's going to send this economy maybe down deeper than it was in 2008, because now the economy is very, very fragile.
Jack, there are people predicting exactly that. I think Europe is so fragile. At least half a dozen countries in Europe are really in very serious trouble. The pink countries, and I mean big ones, Spain and Italy among them. Greece is tiny, but I mean Greece is a basket case. I don't know why they just don't shut the country down economically. I mean, the country is basically bankrupt. But you got Italy and you got Spain, major countries. I mean,
Don't forget UK, France, and Germany here.
Oh,
now
indeed.
You know, the contagion is beginning to spread. France has just tripped over into a recession. UK is already well on its way to a deeper recession.
And Japan, too.
Well, Japan, too, right. Germany has slowed down its growth to, you know, around 1% and so forth. It's not in recession, but it's the only major country and in economy in the EU that is not, Eurozone, that is not in a recession or heading clearly, definitely, forward. Now, poor Greece. Greece has been in a depression for 6 years. well, certainly negative growth for 6 years. And as you know, the other capitalists in Europe, what have they done? They've said, okay, we can't have elected prime ministers because they won't do what we need them to do. So we're going to put pressure on Greece and Italy and get rid of their elected prime ministers and put bankers in charge, which is they did. Talk about democracy. You know, we can manipulate the banking technocrats, but we can't manipulate the prime ministers as well because they're, you know, responsive to some extent to their populace. So let's put the heck with democracy and let's put our own guys in the driver's seat, which is what they've done. And now Spain, 23% unemployment in Spain, 40% youth unemployment. I mean, Spain's in the depression, whether people know or not. And then this past week, Portugal, all of a sudden, you know, Portugal is beginning to look once again like Greece. And, you know, the cost of its bonds are up, you know, 14-15%. They're going to need a Greek-like bailout. So this thing is becoming unraveled. And as I predicted, there would be a little bit of a stabilization here in the first few months of the crisis. And that's because the European Central Bank has, like the Federal Reserve, started pumping hundreds of billions of dollars into the economy because European banks won't lend to each other anymore and companies can't get loans. Just like 2008 here, this is Europe is about August, September 2008 in the whole process. And I predicted that come this spring or summer, then the whole thing will erupt once again. You see, the problem over there is it's going to take between $4 and $5 trillion to do a real bailout, and they've only allocated about $1 trillion. And they're going to find out that that's insufficient. And it's not going to be. It's not going to work. And just yesterday, Germany said that you know, it's the big driver over there of this whole process. Germany said to Greece that you know, look, we're going to have to dictate your spending. In other words, Greece, if we're going to give you another $200 billion for your next round of bailout, we're going to have to okay every check you write, essentially. In other words, Greek sovereignty is about over. And other bureaucrats in Europe are going to be determining the budget and the expenditures of the Greek economy and the Greek people. In other words, you're not moving fast enough, Greece, even with our technocrat in the place. So we got to up the anti-democratic you know, move here, and we're going to have to take over your budget.
Jack, I think a huge wild card in Europe is what began many months ago. Public anger, and the public anger in Europe is expressed much more intensely than it is in America. I mean, people are really furious, and they're expressing it in massive crowds on the streets. You've got some strikes, but they go on for a day or two, and the unions don't go along, so the workers go back. And there are sporadic strikes, but the public anger erupting on the streets. I mean, I think there are real sparks there that could just absolutely explode. I'm amazed that Greece hasn't exploded so far. But you've got it in Spain, you've got it in Italy, you've got it in Portugal. Occasionally, you see it in the UK. I mean, and France. France is notorious for people coming out on the street and in public anger. I mean, the whole continent, Eastern Europe. My God, you've had huge demonstrations in countries like Bulgaria, Hungary, and other countries that just devastated Latvia. If public anger goes past what I like to call a threshold of no return, you can only take so much blood out of the hides of people, and then they're going to reach a breaking point, and they know the politicians are absolutely crushing them, and they refuse to take it anymore, and they don't know what else to do except to take the law in their own hands. Well, these are the sparks that make revolutions, and it's indeed possible that we could see something erupt on the order of a revolution in one country, and if it happens in one place, it could spread to another. I think these criminal politicians, including the bankers that are running Italy and Greece,
They are playing with fire, and there's a good chance they could end up being burned. My God, I sure as hell hope they'll be burned. People no longer should put up with these people are asking of them. And you get the IMF involved in this con game as well.
Well, I would agree with most of what you say, except your repeated reference to politicians, because behind the politicians are the real power. And
the bankers.
The bondholders.
Well, true.
The bankers and bondholders, the bondholders and the bankers are really one. And, of course, they have pretty much control of the politicians. But it's really the bondholders. You know, the whole fight over there is over how much are the people who didn't cause this crisis going to have to pay for the, you know, that's what austerity is, make the people pay, and how much the bondholders are going to have to take a bit of a loss on their bonds. That's the whole thing. They don't want to take any loss. They want to be fully paid for their bonds, you know, even though they and their speculative cousins, you know, hedge funds and so forth, you know, well, the hedge funds are the big part of the bondholders. You know, they are the bondholders, or certainly a big segment of the bondholders. And right now they're negotiating with, the Greek bureaucrats and how much of a cut we're going to have to take in our bond interest returns and how much you're going to have to lay people off and sell the country in order to raise money and cut pensions and so forth. You see, that's what the battle is over. Bondholders don't want to take any loss. The rich don't want to take any loss. It's the same thing going on in this country, but this country has more resources than they do over there in little old Greece. You know, I mean, when the Fed comes in and does its quantitative easing, what does the Fed do? It goes and buys up mortgage bonds. You know, prints money to buy these mortgage bonds from U.S. mortgage investors. Now, buying the bonds, what does that mean? That means I'm going to buy them from you, Mr. Mortgage Investor, which is usually the big banks, but also wealthy individuals and other institutions. Right? I'm going to buy these mortgage bonds from you, and guess what? I'm going to pay full value for them, what you paid for, not the 10% market value that they're worth. You know, they say we got a free market system. Bull. There's nothing about it. If it were a free market system, the Fed would be buying those mortgage bonds at their true market value of 10 cents on the dollar. But instead, what? They're buying at 100 cents on the dollar. In other words, they're giving free money. They're the Fed's being mortgaged to the mortgage lenders is what's happening. It's the same story. They don't want to sell at the true market value. So they get the government, because they control it politically, to buy from them at the inflated value. You know, we spent over $9 trillion. You know, people can debate how much the Fed has thrown in, and, $9 trillion is a low-end estimate. I use the $9 trillion low-end value because some say it's up to over $20 trillion, but that represents rolling over of loans several times by the Fed, right? How much real money is out there? They threw out there about $9 trillion. And then we spent $3 trillion tax cuts and spending, $12 trillion. And what did we get? We got a 1% growth rate last year, 3 years after the crisis. What the heck is going on? Well, there's something really, really wrong with their policies. They're not able to generate a recovery anymore with these policies.
Jackie,
and it looks like the stock market cannot rise without huge monetary injections from the Federal Reserve.
Well, that's exactly right. And, of course, the big difference between America and Europe is the Eurozone countries, especially 14 countries trapped in what I call the Euro straitjacket. They surrendered control of their monetary and really fiscal policy because they have the Maastricht Treaty and the Lisbon Treaty. So, well, I mean, they broke it, but they have restraints. A budget deficit is not supposed to exceed 3% of GDP. But
they exceeded. That's why, you know, Germany is saying to Greece, we're going to write the checks, you know, or we're going to second sign all your checks. You see, that means we're going to take fiscal control.
Well, that's exactly right. But the Eurozone countries cannot print their own money. I mean, it's a terrible system. The Fed, you know, I mean, the Fed can, there's no limit on how much money the Fed can print. And, of course, the Fed is Wall Street. The big Wall
right.
Street banks own the Fed. It's not federal.
People aren't aware of this, but I'll let them know. Who pays for the lights and all the other operating costs of the Federal Reserve. Who pays the monthly bills for the Federal Reserve? The banks pay their monthly bills. Right? Is this a federal institution? Well, Congress passed the law, you know, and Congress could step in and take more control of the whole thing. You know, but the Fed is a heavily private institution still. It was even worse back in the 20s. And then, you know, the 30s came and the government assumed a little bit more control over the Fed. In fact, during the Depression, what happened? The Treasury, FDR's Treasury, told the Fed to go sit in the corner. Get out of here. We're going to run the monetary show from now on. And the Fed did that. And, you know, it took 4 or 5 decades for the Fed in the late 50s and 60s to reemerge, i.e. the bankers to reemerge, as, you know, an important private institution, banking institution. And now, the ECB, the European Central Bank, which is the analog of the Fed over in Europe, you know, has bought some time, just like the Fed bought time here in the United States, has bought some time, and it is pumping money now into the banking system because the banks won't loan to each other anymore. They don't know who's really in the worst shape, and many of them are in bad shape. In my predicted article here, Economic Predictions, which is on my website, published in Z Magazine in January 1st, you know, I predicted that you know, this euro crisis would erupt once again this spring summer, and that I even identified the banks that were in the greatest trouble. You know, UniCredit in Italy, Santander in Spain, and the French banks are in trouble here, particularly Societe Generale and Credit Agricole and the BNP Paribas, the three big French banks, Commerce Bank in Germany, and of course the Austrian and the British banks are in trouble as well if the others go down.
Oh, they sure are. They sure are.
Now, people aren't probably aware that the Federal Reserve, knowing how serious this is, has already pumped about $80 billion into the European banks.
Most people don't know that.
They don't know that.
The Fed is printing
money.
And
they're poised to pump even more into the European banks.
The ECB is more, they're printing money, they're helping out, but they're more restrained than the Fed. I mean the ECB creates hundreds of billions, and the Fed creates multi-trillions. And the Fed is bailing out, they did it in 2008, they're bailing out the European banks. And of course, the deal that the bankers want is they want ordinary people to pay so that they get paid. You know, keep them afloat. They're the ones who caused this problem. But be sure, but bankers get paid first. That's the deal. So they have their people in charge, whether it's a politician or a banker. The banker, the politician represents the bankers. Pay the bankers, then worry about everything else. But the other part of the deal is sell off all the valued state assets, privatize. Is the magic word, privatized, which is another word for plunder. You know, you buy it at cut rate prices. So Greece is on sale, Jack. I think everything is on sale short of the Parthenon, and I expect that to go on the block.
Yes, I think you're right. Well, you know, a minute ago I said the Fed in the U.S. Pumped in $9 trillion. Well, $1 trillion of that went to European banks in 2008. And if we think that the United States is decoupled from what's going on in Europe, I mean, that is a totally erroneous assumption. Europe collapsed along with us in 2008, the banking system. When the European banking system collapsed, so will the pressure on the United States. Why do you think that Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, just this past week said he is going to extend zero interest rates, loans to banks at zero interest rates in the United States, that's been going on since December 8th, that was supposed to stop a year from now, he's going to extend it 2 more years.
It's
to the
shocking,
end of 2014.
Jack.
Why do you think he came out, if we're growing so great now and we got a recovery, why is he assuring that we're going to have zero interest rates, which benefit the banks? You know, zero. The banks can go borrow from the Fed. We can't.
And think of what he's doing, Jack.
think of what he's doing. He's giving the banks free money. He's making people like seniors get nothing
That's right.
on their
it's
savings.
A transfer. It's a transfer of wealth
transfer
from people
wealth.
Who rely on savings accounts and CDs and so forth for a little bit of retirement money and so forth. He's just turning around and giving it to the banks, you know? And my point is, Bernanke and the Fed see what's coming. That's why they're giving these signals and extending zero rates as long as they are. They know what's coming. They are really worried. You know, the Geithner runs over to Europe every other week and says, God, you guys got to do this, you guys got to do that. You know, Treasury Secretary Geithner, you know, Bernanke. At the very top, they're keeping it under cover, but they are really, really worried about what's going on over there. You see, in my article and in my books, I forecast these major turning points. That's why my predictions have been accurate. I predicted at the end of 2009 that there would be a sovereign banking crisis, sovereign crisis, in two or more European countries. And then in the spring of 2010, Greece erupted for the first time. You know, and then I predicted after that that the euro would split up, and they're going to have to create a two-tier currency over in Europe. So this is based upon my analysis of epic recession, which is not a mainstream economic analysis. It's based on an argument that the U.S. and the global system is systemically fragile. And then I define what fragility means in this case. I won't go into it here on your show, but...
Jack, we're just about out of time. I'm going to let you wrap up with a couple of comments. But I would just say that Bob Chapman, an insider who comes on this program talking about the economy, he sees the collapse coming. He just can't pinpoint the timing. He said it could happen any time from now until 5 years from now. But the collapse is coming. Make no mistake about it.
Well, you know, my epic recession says that you get no sustained recovery, and you get another double dip. And I'm predicting, and since 2009 have predicted, that the time period for this to happen is sometime between 2012 and 2014. That's when you get the second financial crisis. And we seem to be on that track, and the next one will come in Europe and spread everywhere else.
Oh, if we sure are, Jack. We are out of time. It's another great hour, and I look forward to reading your GDP article. I'll go to your website after the program is over and read that article. And I love your stuff, and I love to quote you in my articles, and it's great having you on this program. I look forward to getting you back next month.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jack. And join us tomorrow, of course, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern. Oh, another good guest, another good program. Absolutely make this a regular habit.